quick announcement.
Number four, yes. So today, no algebra, but we talk about rigidity. And in particular about isomorphisms. Of algebraic ZD actions. Let's start with a simple problem. You take two Z-squared actions. Today I'm going to restrict myself to actions on zero-dimensional compact abelian groups. The connected case will follow tomorrow. So take two polynomials, like this one of our friends from yesterday. So the polynomial f is equal to 1 plus u1 plus u2 plus u1 squared plus u1 u2 plus u2 squared. Let's call this f1. And the other polynomial looks pretty much the same, except that it has one entry missing, like this one. Could have been any other one. But I want them to have the same convex hull of their support. So F2 is 1 plus U1 plus U2 plus U1 squared plus U2 squared. And we look at the modules R2 modulo the prime ideal 2, F1, and in this case we take F2 instead of F1. So this is our module M1, this is our module M2, and corresponding to this we have an action alpha 1 on X1, which is just the Pontryagin dual of M1. One, and here we have alpha 2. And the question is whether these actions can be measurably conjugate. So R, alpha 1 and alpha 2, measurably conjugate. A slightly more general version is, of course, you take any two polynomials, F1 and F2, and keep the constants the same, and you want to know whether you could have conjugacy without having equality of the polynomials. So what are the possible invariants you could try to decide this question? Remember what the spaces look like. Say if the space X1 is the set of all doubly indexed sequences XKL in, if you do it according to the rules, you find that each coordinate must be either 0 or 1/2, and that the coordinates summed over any translate of this region in Z squared should be equal to 0 mod 1. So you could, if you prefer to think of it that way, you could just choose zeros and ones as coordinates. And so it's 0, 1 to the z squared, and the sum over this region is always equal to 0. No matter where you place it, you always get the sum 0. And for the other one, you just get a slightly different rule for summing. So, for example, you could look at individual automorphisms of the action, like the horizontal shift. What's the end? The horizontal shift is an ergodic group automorphism. Now, ergodic group automorphisms are all Bernoulli. And the only thing which distinguishes two Bernoulli automorphisms is the entropy. So what's the entropy of the horizontal shift here? Well, let's work it out. The entropy is maybe I shouldn't try and derive this formula, but the entropy in this case is log 4, and the reason is that if you know all the coordinates in some wide strip like this, what can you choose here? You can choose two coordinates, and then the next one is determined because you know what's written here and you know what's written here. So there are two coordinates which you can choose freely, and then the rest you can fill in. Okay? So the entropy is log 4. That is what you learn what you forget if you remove this information. You forget this entry and this entry. There are four possibilities for those for choosing zeros and ones here. There are no restrictions, so the entropy is log 4. The same thing is true here, because all we were using is actually the shape of the convex hull of this support. So I'm not going to do all the other directions, but all the directional entropies are the same. And they are, in fact, directional entropies initially are only defined for rational directions, because you're in z-squared, so you have to move to some other lattice site in maybe some distance away. But this directional entropy they all coincide, and they are determined by the support, or even the convex hull of the support, of the polynomials. What else? Well, yesterday I talked a lot about non-mixing sets. Here I explained briefly that this set is already non-mixing, and the same thing is true here. I'm not going to do the calculation. So they have the same minimal non-mixing sets. So the two most obvious invariants, maybe this is less obvious than this one, coincide for these two actions. We also know that because the directional entropies coincide, that for each direction, in other words, for each n, alpha 1 n and alpha 2 n are Bernoulli automorphisms with the same entropy, so they're isomorphic. But we have to find an isomorphism which carries all of these automorphisms to all of these automorphisms and not just any particular one of them. I mean, these are examples where maybe one can prove it directly, but the general problem is, given two such polynomials, how can you tell whether they are measurably conjugate? And these are just very special algebraic ZD actions, so more generally, take two mixing algebraic ZD actions on compact zero-dimensional abelian groups. Can they be isomorphic? I keep saying zero-dimensional, and I keep saying that next time I'll do the connected case, but nothing zero-dimensional can ever be conjugate to anything connected, provided it's zero entropy. Let's look at another example. What happens if we take, let's take F3, how shall I explain this? These examples have zero entropy as z-squared actions. The isomorphism problem has an obvious solution if you have positive entropy, Because with positive entropy, you're essentially, I'm now cheating, in the Bernoulli case. I'll give you one example. Let's take the shift action of z squared on z mod 2z squared to the z squared. So this is the Cartesian product of two groups of order 2, or on z mod 4z to the z squared, then these two are obviously isomorphic. Because the alphabet in one case is a four-point set, in the other case it's a four-point set, and you don't even care that these are groups. So these two actions are isomorphic without any algebraic isomorphism being possible. This group has order 2, this group has order 4. But here we have zero entropy groups, zero entropy actions, and it's certainly not so easy to construct isomorphisms or prove that no such isomorphism can exist. So this is... Oh yes, there was another example which I wanted to mention. Here, there is no obvious connection between these two actions. But I would like now to write down two also z-squared actions with zero entropy, where there is a connection between the two actions. Namely, there is a 2-to-1 map, a 2-to-1 factor map from one action to the other. And the question is whether they are also isomorphic without this 2-to-1, whether there is another map which is actually a bijection between these two actions. So we take F1 again, and we take an element omega in the algebraic closure of F2 with omega cubed is equal to 1. So in other words, a third root of unity in the algebraic closure of the prime field of order 2. Then I said yesterday that F1 is equal to 1 plus omega U1 plus omega squared U2 times 1 plus omega squared U1 plus omega U2. Now let's look at two modules. One is R2, 2 modulo F, you will notice. So this is R2, 2 is F2 of, U1 to the plus minus 1, U2 to the plus minus 1. And you will notice that this is nothing but our module M1. I have simply taken the 2, which was in the prime ideal, and moved it over to the ring itself. So the ring is now the set of Laurent polynomials with coefficients in F2, in the prime field of order 2, in the two variables X1 and X2. We take G to be 1 plus omega U1 plus omega squared U2. This is now an element of the ring R2, two variables. But up here we have a 4, which is the field of size 4, U2 plus minus 1. And the other module is R2, 4 mod G. It's M3 now. Then you have an injective map from here to here. This is an injective map. And it's just given by sending each polynomial in R2, 2, in other words, coefficients mod 2, to the identical polynomial here, then the kernel of this map is precisely the ideal given by F. So this is an injective map, and the image has index 2. I ask you to believe that, but it's very easy to check. So these are, we view both of these as modules over the original ring R2, and we get here a group X3. This was an injective map, so dually we have a surjective map from X3 to X1. So X3 is nothing but M3 hat, and this is 2 to 1, and that's the dual of this injection here. So I'll stop algebra again, since I had actually promised not to do any. So all this means is that we now have two Z-squared actions on compact zero-dimensional abelian groups, and this one is a 2-to-1 factor of this one. Are they measurably conjugate? Again, for Bernoulli automorphisms, a 2-to-1 factor map does not change entropy, so the individual elements of the two actions are always isomorphic. Whether the actions are isomorphic or not is not so easy to decide. The reason why I start discussion of this problem in the zero-dimensional case is that there is a reasonably complete solution here, but there is no complete solution in the connected case at this stage. So let me present a theorem which is due to Bhattacharya. Very recent. His result is much more general. Here we are always talking about ZD actions. The general statement he proved is for gamma is a discrete group. Always countable. And X1, alpha 1, X2, alpha 2 are algebraic gamma actions. In other words, X1 and X2 are compact abelian groups. Alpha 1 and alpha 2 are homomorphisms from gamma into the automorphism groups of X1 and X2 respectively. And we assume that alpha 1 is mixing. Maybe I should just very briefly say what this means. It means the same equation we had last time. If you take two sets, you keep one set in its original position and apply a sequence in gamma tending to infinity to the second set, then the measures of the intersection should tend to the product of the measures of the two sets. So we assume that alpha 1 is mixing, and that there exists a k greater than or equal to maybe 2, such that for any closed alpha 2 invariant subgroup Y in X2, the restriction of alpha 2 to Y2 is not mixing, is not K mixing. Is not K plus 1 mixing. So this is why this lecture follows yesterday's lecture. we were talking about the fact that for zero entropy, ZD actions on compact abelian groups, zero-dimensional compact abelian groups, there are non-mixing sets. So in particular, there is a bound on the order of mixing these actions can have. And this bound is actually global, even over restrictions to all possible closed invariant subgroups. So suppose that there exists such a K, then any measurable equivariant map phi from x1 to x2, I'll explain equivariant in a moment, is a measurable polynomial, which I'll also explain in a moment, of degree less than or equal to k minus 1. So this may not look wildly exciting, but let me first of all fill in the necessary terms. So equivariant means that phi alpha 1 n, no, gamma we have gamma actions, is equal to alpha 2 gamma phi for all gamma in gamma. And this is true almost everywhere with respect to the Ha measure on the first group. The measure is always Ha measure. That's the natural measure which sits on these spaces. So this is what equivariant means. It just intertwines the two actions. We are not assuming that phi is surjective. Now, what is a measurable polynomial? Let's take a map phi from x1 to x2, and let's take an element x in x1. Oh, excuse me, let me make this a z. Then dz phi of x is defined as phi of x plus z minus phi of x. It's just a measurable map. Phi is a measurable map defined almost everywhere. This is, again, a measurable map defined almost everywhere. Then phi is a measurable polynomial of degree, say, L, if dz1 to dz, L plus 1, I think, yes, L plus 1 phi is equal to 0, lambda almost everywhere for every choice of z1 to zl plus 1 in the group x1. What's a polynomial of degree 1? What's a polynomial of degree 0? So degree 0 means that for every z, sorry, let me give you time to digest this for a second. So degree 0 means for any z, this is equal to 0 almost everywhere. It means that phi is constant. What does degree 1 mean? If you think for a second, you'll see that it means that phi is affine. So degree 0, phi is constant almost everywhere. Degree 1, phi is equal to affine, to an affine map, almost everywhere. These are maps which are only defined almost everywhere, so we only can expect that phi coincides with some affine map apart, possibly on a null set, apart from a null set. Now, constants are continuous, affine maps are continuous, and one can prove by induction, all polynomials coincide almost everywhere with a continuous map. That's extremely nice and useful because it tells you that at least once you check that these conditions are satisfied for some actions, that a measurable conjugacy is in fact a topological conjugacy, which means there are lots and lots of additional invariants you can check to see whether they differ for these two actions. So let me write down two corollaries. The first one is the situation we are interested in. You take two mixing algebraic ZD actions with zero entry on compact abelian group on zero dimensional . So you take two such actions, they are the actions we are discussing in this lecture, with zero entropy. Are measurably conjugate if and only if they are topologically conjugate. Because for such actions, we decided yesterday that they cannot be mixing of every order. In fact, there is some bound which is given by supports of polynomials which define these actions. And Bhattacharya's theorem says that any measurable equivariant map is a polynomial, and polynomials are automatically continuous, give or take a null set. There is another corollary which is quite striking, which is also due to Bhattacharya. Before I formulated an additional lemma on connected groups, which is the situation we've been excluding so far, all polynomials have degree less than or equal to 1. In other words, all polynomials are affine. This is, again, proved by induction. Again, not very difficult. So if you can prove that something's a polynomial there, you have, in fact, proved that it's an affine map. Therefore, if you have such a phi appearing as a conjugacy, the two actions are algebraically isomorphic because the translation part of the affine map can be removed. But here's the corollary. Which appears in the same paper of Bhattacharya where this first result is proved. Let gamma be a torsion-free discrete group which is not virtually abelian. This means it doesn't have a subgroup of finite index which is abelian. Okay? That was the definition of virtually abelian. It is not a finite extension of an abelian group. And let X alpha be a mixing algebraic gamma action on a compact connected finite dimensional abelian group. Finite dimensional means that it's a finite dimensional solenoid or a finite dimensional torus, and you could define it, if you like, by demanding that it contains a dense subgroup, which is a homomorphic image of some finite dimensional Euclidean space. So the standard solenoid contains a dense copy of R. But of course, there are bigger solenoids which contain dense copies of RK, and it's these groups which we are talking about. Then, the restriction of alpha to Y is going to be a closed alpha invariant subgroup of X, is not mixing of order dimension of X, that's the dimension I was talking about here, plus 1 for any closed alpha invariant subgroup Y contained in X. That's a theorem, which is not obvious. But with this theorem and with this corollary and this theorem, you now see that if you take two such actions, which are measurably conjugate, then they're automatically affine. The measurable conjugacy itself is an affine map. Because if you now take two of these, so we have x1 alpha 1 and x2 alpha 2, and you have a measurable conjugacy between them, this mixing condition is satisfied, so the measurable conjugacy must be affine, but affine maps on connected groups, the measurable conjugacy is a polynomial, but polynomials on connected groups are affine. Therefore, there is an affine conjugacy between these two, which coincides with the original phi, apart from a null set. And then if you want to do that, you can remove the translation part of the affine map, because if there is an affine conjugacy, then the group isomorphism part of the conjugacy is again a conjugacy. So this is a theorem which has almost no assumptions, but has a very strong statement about isomorphism rigidity of such actions. If they are measurably conjugate, they're automatically algebraically conjugate, and the conjugacy itself must be algebraic. But let's get back to our setting, where we talk about ZT actions. Can I take this off? So let's get back to the first corollary. And what we would really like to know is whether we can improve this and replace polynomial by a polynomial of degree less than or equal to 1, in other words, by an affine map. What we have learned from this theorem is that the map is automatically continuous. So now let's use another tool, which I'm about to start describing, to deduce that under one additional assumption, this measurable polynomial, in fact, has to be affine. And this additional concept, which we now need, is the notion of homoclinic points. So we start with an algebraic ZT action. I'm not assuming now that X is disconnected. X can be connected. It's just a compact abelian group. A point X in X is homoclinic if the limit as n tends to infinity of alpha n x is equal to 0. So no matter which way you move it to infinity, the point always converges to 0. Here are some theorems which, they were joint work with Doug Lind. First of all, if alpha is expansive, remember, expansive means that no two points shadow each other throughout their entire orbits, or equivalently, since we are in a group and we are talking about automorphisms, there is no point distinct from zero which always stays close to zero along its entire orbit. So if alpha is expansive, the group delta alpha of x of homoclinic points of alpha is countable. It's clear that if you take two such points and you add them, you get another homoclinic point. So the set of homoclinic points is a subgroup, and expansiveness forces this subgroup to be countable. If you want to see that expansiveness is really necessary for that, just take the shift action of z to the d on t to the z to the d. That has uncountably many homoclinic points, because a point is homoclinic here if its coordinates, as you move out, get closer to zero. And it's clear that there are uncountably many points with this property. We just make the coordinates small as n tends to infinity. Secondly, if delta alpha of x is non-zero, then the entropy of alpha is positive. One can even try to think of the group as a subgroup of this T to the ZD. Then a homoclinic point is a point which is somewhere non-zero, and then outside some compact region, it's very, very small. Each coordinate is very, very small. So you can take this point, and you can place an independent copy of the same point, a shifted copy of the same point, on some kind of grid. And at each position of the grid, you can decide whether to place a point of like this at this position or not. So you see something like a full two shift in Z to the in X, and that has positive entropy. Three, if alpha is expansive, then delta alpha of X is dense in X if and only if alpha has completely positive entropy. That's this notion which I've never properly explained, but which I have at least talked about somewhat vaguely on several occasions. It means that there are, in fact, you could also define it, there are no algebraic quotients, in other words, quotient groups, on which the action has zero entropy. Okay. So how can homoclinic points help in this setting where we are always restricting ourselves to ZD actions with zero entropy? Because for positive entropy, isomorphism is there can be many isomorphisms between different looking things. The idea is that although if the ZD action alpha has zero entropy, there may be some subspace of Z to the D, like Z to the D minus 1, say, or maybe just a copy of Z, which acts expansively and with positive entropy. And this subaction can then have homoclinic points. And if you're lucky, this set of homoclinic points is going to be dense. That's if the subaction has completely positive entropy. I will just sketch let's look at this group of homoclinic points to see what they actually look like. And let's take our most familiar example, where we take Le Drapier's example. So it's X sits inside Z mod 2Z to the Z squared, and it's given by this condition that wherever you add three adjacent coordinates in this configuration, you get sum equal to zero. So this is a Z squared action with zero entropy, and from that, or from a direct calculation, which isn't hard, you can check that there are no non-zero homoclinic points. But there are Z actions sitting in there which are expansive and which have positive entropy, in fact completely positive entropy, and whose homoclinic points are therefore dense. I will do it only for this example, but the recipe I'm giving is actually much more general. So it also works for anything of the form RD mod P, where P is equal to some rational prime Q pi, say, and F pi is a rational prime. Here it's 2. So, here's our basic configuration. If we avoid, let's look at the horizontal shift. I claim the horizontal shift is not expansive. the reason is we could have a point which is zero on the upper half plane. Remember, our points are of this form. So it means that to each lattice height, to each coordinate in Z squared, we have to attach a 0 or a 1. And I'm attaching zeros to all the coordinates above some horizontal line. Then underneath, we can have something like this. So if we move this point downwards, if we move this line of further down, there's something more irregular. It'll be something like this, and then it sort of you get zeros and ones with increasing periods 2 to the n. So if we shift this point downwards and then look at it in some wide horizontal strip, we only see zeros, but far away from this strip we are watching, the point is non-zero, so that's not expansive. This is a point which is not equal to zero, but which under the horizontal shift never gets very far away from zero. And the reason is that we've picked a direction which is parallel to one of the edges of the support of the polytope described by the support of F. So the same thing happens when you look at the vertical shift. That is not expansive. Because again, you can find a half space of zeros and continue the point in a non-zero way. There is a third non-expansive direction, and that's this one. So the non-expansive directions, let's look at it projectively, are the horizontal direction. I'm just looking at the directions in R squared as unit vectors. The vertical direction is non-expansive, and this diagonal is non-expansive. All directions in the sectors, inside these sectors, are expansive. So, for example, if you look at this diagonal here, if you know these coordinates, so I'm marking out a strip in that which has that angle, then if I fix the coordinates in this strip, it determines the entire point. So if you have two distinct points, they must differ somewhere inside this strip, and then you can shift it somewhere in this direction, and you actually see the difference close to where you stand. And the same thing is true with any other direction. Okay. Now, what do the homoclinic points look like? I shouldn't have wiped this off. What are the homoclinic points in this direction? Homoclinic means that if you move the point sufficiently far in this direction, you get zeros. Right? A homoclinic point for this shift in the direction 1, 1 is a point which eventually converges to zero as you move to infinity. So in other words, whatever you may have at some of these coordinates, at some stage you only have zeros here in this strip. Then you use the polynomial, here it is, to start filling in things, and you see that this also has to be zero, because these three have to add up to zero. This has to be zero, so this has to be zero, so this has to be zero, this has to be zero, and so on, and you find that having zeros along this diagonal strip of width 2 forces zeros in this complete half space, all zeros. What happens up here? Let's suppose we have zeros now along here. and we have to check again what is forced by these zeros. Well, we have to have another zero here. We have to have a zero here, and so on, and you find that you get zeros in this cone. So this is a homoclinic point for this 45-degree upwards shift, but it's actually homoclinic for a lot more directions than that. It's homoclinic for any direction in this arc. And in fact, the homoclinic points for all the directions in any of these arcs are identical. Now, I think it was Katok who introduced the term Weyl chambers for these sets of directions. He had reasons for it, although he was looking at commuting toral automorphisms, so that's closer to the original setting of Weyl chambers. But it's a good name here as well. So the homoclinic points are not dependent on a particular direction, but only on the Weyl chambers in which these directions lie. So if we number the Weyl chambers W1, W2, W3, we've got all of them because this one is the same as this one. It's projective. There are three possible homoclinic groups associated with the directions in these chambers. Now, two of these groups can intersect non-trivially. I'm not going to draw this because I'll be running out of time and tape. But the idea of the proof, which of the rigidity result, is to find two Weyl chambers. So each Weyl chamber carries its own group of homoclinic points. You want to find two Weyl chambers which have no homoclinic point in common. You want a bit more than that. I'll write down what is necessary for the proof, and then you'll see what the statement of the theorem is. So suppose that there exist two Weyl chambers whose homoclinic groups are both dense, and have zero intersection. You have to pick your Weyl chambers carefully, because if you just pick two arbitrary Weyl chambers, the intersection of the homoclinic points may not be zero. For commuting toral automorphisms, it's simpler in a way. The homoclinic groups either coincide or they have zero intersection. Here they can overlap. So, now, I'll just give you a very elementary sketch of the argument. This is the isomorphism between two actions which you want to investigate. So you have two actions, alpha 1 and alpha 2. You have this isomorphism phi, which we've decided now is continuous. And we look at this expression. Oops. We look at this expression here. This, at the moment, this is just a map from x1 cross x1 to x2. Now, in x2, choose your two Weyl chambers with this property. So this, a Weyl chamber, that's a lot of possible directions. In each Weyl chamber, I haven't told you how to draw this diagram properly in Z to the D, I've only drawn it for Z squared. So in each vial chamber, you've got many, infinitely many different directions to choose from, and there are only finitely many vial chambers, so there are only finitely many bad directions where you don't get any information. So you choose in the first group X1, that's where you want to have dense homoclinic groups, something which is homoclinic in one direction, homoclinic for one, so we want this statement here has to be read twice, once for each group, once for the group X1 and once for the group X2. So we want dense for X1 and zero intersection for X2. The zero intersection is the harder bit. So you look at the target group and you choose your two vial chambers with that property. Now, vial chambers give you directions. In the first group, there must be some directions amongst these infinitely many which you have available, which are expansive. And there you want dense homoclinic groups for these directions. So now you have got a dense choice. You choose X in delta alpha 1 of X1 and Y in delta alpha 1 prime of X1 delta M delta N. These are two directions. These are two. M and N are elements of Z squared. I'm staying with Z squared for the moment. We are looking at homoclinic elements in X1, which are homoclinic in this particular direction, which converge to zero if you move them a long way in a positive or negative multiple, by a positive or negative multiple of M, same here. Now, look at this point in X2 now. If you move this point in the direction M, then the X component, remember, phi is an equivariant map, so the action passes right through. So if you move this point here in the direction M, then the X tends to zero. But if X tends to zero, then the whole expression tends to zero. If you move this point in the direction N, then the Y tends to zero, so the whole expression tends to zero. So this point is homoclinic both in the M direction and in the N direction. But M and N lie in two vial chambers which have no homoclinic points in common, so this is zero. Therefore, the map is affine, because it is zero on a dense subset. This is where we need the density of delta M X1 and delta N X2. End of proof. What we have to check is whether the hypotheses are satisfied. And the theorem is, if, this is joint work by Bhattacharya and myself, if alpha 1 has a subaction, this is so gamma in Z to the D, in other words, it's a subgroup of lower rank, typically. Well, if alpha 1 has a subaction which is expansive, and has completely positive entropy, then phi, this is the equivariant map which we had in the beginning of this whole discussion, then phi is affine. all these conditions are necessary. One can construct counterexamples if this condition here is not satisfied. But what I was trying to explain here is that the isomorphism rigidity result for zero-dimensional groups depends on the breakdown of higher-order mixing. That is what was needed for Bhattacharya's theorem. Bhattacharya's theorem gave automatic continuity of measurable conjugacy, and that allowed topological tools, namely homoclinic points, to be used for the proof. Then, of course, you have to worry whether the homoclinic points have the right properties, so you need some assumptions, and that's what this result states. If the actions alpha 1 and alpha 2 are on connected groups, this doesn't work because there is no automatic continuity result. Tomorrow I'll talk a little bit about what one can prove there. Thank you. If you look at, so what's the standard Weyl group? So if you look at commuting toral automorphisms, you have let's assume that they have that this group has maximal rank. So in other words, they're simultaneously diagonalizable. Okay. Then, if you have commuting toral, and I'll be talking about that a little more tomorrow, but you get common eigenvalues and eigenvectors. Now, what is an eigenvalue? An eigenvalue, if you have several commuting maps, is a homomorphism. Suppose you have D commuting maps, then an eigenvalue is a homomorphism from Z to the D, or if the group is continuous, it's something like R to the D, into the complex numbers. Now, something interesting happens for elements in the acting group which lie in the kernel of one of these homomorphisms. And there you begin to see the connection with the Weyl chambers. So you get certain directions